I mean, people felt that running under sub 4 minutes for a mile was impossible, and I think there are hundreds have done it now, and several did it within a couple of months of Bannister first doing it. So I think it just resets people's mindsets as much as anything. And you know, I think when the world record, well, you know, it was, or the fastest time ever run for the marathon was 2:02, then the 18-year-olds around the world, and in Kenya and Ethiopia in particular, were thinking, well, you know, maybe one day I can run 2:01. But now Eliud Kipchoge's run 2 hours and 25 seconds, they'd be thinking, maybe I can be, you know, so they're already thinking differently about it.
That was Professor Andrew Jones talking about the sub-2-hour marathon, and this is a rather different episode 68 of the All Things Risk podcast. Welcome and welcome back to another episode of the All Things Risk podcast. My name is Ben Cattaneo. I'm your host. This is the show where we explore risk and uncertainty and learn from fascinating guests about decision making, how to take risks, and about the biggest risks of our time. Now, normally, I do long-form conversations with some of the most interesting people in the world. This episode is a little bit different, not because we don't have interesting guests. Quite the opposite, actually. I have 3 fascinating guests this week. However, it isn't exactly long form. Today, I bring you 3 short conversations I had with leading scientists who've been studying the limits of animal and human physiology. And this is a set of conversations that took place at the sidelines of this year's Human Nature Conference, which happened in London's Natural History Museum last month. Now, this is a conference that's sponsored by the Society for Experimental Biology, and it's absolutely fascinating. Now, I had Mark Hannaford on the show on episode 65, and Mark is one of the co-organizers of the conference, and do check out episode 65 if you haven't. Mark and I talked on that episode about extreme medicine and how we as humans continue to push and make discoveries at the extremes of our physiologies, of our environments. And that's whether we're talking about remote locations or even space exploration. And venturing into the unknown and dealing with uncertainty is what we're all about here. And the Human Nature Conference really brings to light the fact that, look, animal species have been pushing their physiologies for millennia. And this is a conference that brings experts together who look at both the animal and human sides of this coin. So I was fortunate enough to have these short conversations with 3 speakers. I first talked to Dr. Andreas Fahlmann, who is an oceanographer. Second is Dr. Carl Soulsbury, who is a behavioral ecologist, and we talked about birds exercising to their limits and beyond. And finally, I spoke to Dr. Andrew Jones, who is a professor of applied physiology at the University of Exeter here in the UK. And he very recently worked with Nike around an attempt to get at least one elite marathon runner to break the 2-hour barrier in the marathon. So these were very fascinating conversations. A word of warning is that I recorded them at the Museum of Natural History here in London, so there's a bit of background noise. Apologies in advance. I don't think it detracts from the content, but just wanted to let you know. But here we go. I start with my conversation with Dr. Andreas Fahlmann, and we talk about, or he explains to me, diving physiology in animals and how that can be used to assess the health of the environment. Andreas, thank you for joining, speaking to me for a few minutes. I wanted to, first of all, just for my listeners, what do you do?
I'm a comparative physiologist, so basically I'm a car mechanic, but trying to understand animals. So instead of understanding what's under the hood on the car, I'm trying to understand what's under the skin of an animal and how they can do certain performances. So, you know, a Maserati can drive really fast, a dolphin can dive really deep and for a very long time, and how do they do that? What's in the machinery? So we're trying to measure this in different ways for different animals, and there are different ways of doing it. And we study both animals under human care, so in zoos and aquariums, or we study animals in the wild, and then try to, a lot of what we're trying to do nowadays is creating tools to understand animals in the wild. We're trying to validate tools within the aquariums, and then we bring them to animals in the wild, either for diagnostic purposes to try to understand, sort of like a thermometer for the environment. So if we can understand the health of these animals, we can understand if the ecosystem is healthy. So this is one of the aspects of this. And then we're noticing, and what we can see with these meetings that we've had here is that there's a lot of overlap. So you have ecologists, you have clinicians, you have physiologists that are working on similar topics but in different systems. So either in different ecosystems or in different animal systems. And we're looking at the same thing. And by bridging these boundaries we have in between, I think we can learn a lot. And that has been my sort of what I've been trying to do for the last 10, 15 years. So where you work with mathematicians, you work with veterinarians, you work with clinicians, and then they bring... It's sort of like painting. So my color is blue and someone else has green and someone has red, and then we can make something that is much more colorful and it looks like something rather than, you know, monotone blue splatters.
Very cool, very much in the multidisciplinary way of looking at the world, which is always, I think, one of the most valuable ways in which we can look at the world. You gave a talk this morning about comparative diving ecophysiology, a tool for assessing environmental health. So that sounds like a mouthful. Could you sum up what some of the key themes of that talk were to people who might be listening?
Yeah, what we're trying to do is, like I mentioned, we're trying to understand what are the boundaries of physiological function in these animals. So, for example, if an animal dives to a marine mammal or a turtle or anyone that is an air-breathing vertebrate dive to 10 meters to obtain food, and that's where their food store is. Their currency is number of molecules of oxygen. So they only have so many molecules of oxygen in their system. It's either in the blood, it's in the muscles, or it's in the lungs. And they can then dive to this depth for this amount of time and obtain this much food. And then it depends on how much food is at that depth. And if you move that food resource much deeper down, which potentially is going to happen with changes in the environment or to higher latitudes, that means that they have to swim for a much longer period of time to get to the food store or to get to their resource to obtain the food. So they have less time available for getting the food, which means less food. So how do they compensate for that? So do they need to dive more times? Do they need to dive for a longer period of time to get that? And at what point in time is that limiting for, so basically they can't get enough food. So consider your paycheck, and now you have the same paycheck, but your food store moves 15 kilometers or 15 miles down the road. Gas prices go up 300%. So now you only make so much money. So now you still have to pay, you have to drive an additional time, you have to pay extra money to get to the food store. So this is sort of an equivalent that you can't get as much food. And at what point in time, what is the distance, the maximum distance you can drive to the food store for it to make sense and for you to actually get enough food?
And what are you finding in the research?
What we're looking at, basic physiological parameters of trying to understand
those limits.
The physiological limits of diving, for example. And what we're seeing is we don't have any real numbers at the moment, but what we're seeing is that these animals may have huge physiological capacities. So, for example, there are dolphins that are in some environments and they only dive for a few minutes, for 3, 4, 5, 10 meters. Then you have other populations that can dive extremely deep for long periods of time. So what are the differences in physiological competence between these? So it's sort of like the couch potato human versus the marathon runner human. So there's a huge scope for physiological change. Can you change that over lifetime? Can you change that with training? We don't know that yet. But we are slowly getting these numbers of, you know, how do these animals that dive really deep compensate for the additional duration they have to diet? What are they eating? What are their food sources? Is it more energetically preferable, the food source that they're getting? So we're still struggling with understanding this.
It sounds very sounds like a very pertinent type of research given changes with the climate, and I imagine the food stores and sources move around.
Yeah,
we'll be moving around.
There is a lot of evidence for these things to change. So there is evidence for fish moving either to deeper depths or to higher latitudes. There is changes in prey resources. There is overfishing. There's this whole cascade of things that are happening, and I think that it's pertinent to try to understand how are these animals going to be impacted. We can also look at some of the things that we're doing our diagnostic. So we're trying to understand and creating diagnostic tool to be able to look at what is there now. So if things happen in the environment, if there's an oil spill, for example, the one that was in New Orleans, the Deepwater Horizon, now they're trying to restore something that was before. But if you don't know what was before, if we don't have an understanding of what was before the oil spill, we can't assess the impact of the oil spill. We can't assess how to restore it back to before. So understanding this is something that we can also do with these tools. So we can try to assess changes from what was before if we have a sense of it.
I think I get it.
Yeah.
That's great. Did you take away? So you spent 2 days looking at a variety of human and animal behaviors and adaptations in extremes. What were some of the takeaways that, or maybe one key takeaway from the last couple of days that stuck with you?
We really need to try to change the way that we're focusing on things, rather than focusing on, you know, some people are reductionists and they look at and they become experts in something. But I think there's a lot of benefit to try to look across boundaries, and that's what I think this multi. When you have people with lots of different backgrounds, you're starting to see commonalities, and you're starting to see where you can potentially learn from other disciplines.
So it's possibly connections or research techniques. Or
yeah,
all of that.
Yeah. Wow. A lot of the medical industry, the clinicians, they have all these really, really interesting tools that we could potentially use to understand animals better. The animals have these adaptations or these traits that could help us understand or potentially make clinical applications and treat people with certain problems in the emergency clinic or during surgery.
Okay. One final question, and that is, what area of research or what areas of research excite you the most in the coming years?
This cardiorespiratory work that we're currently doing with dolphins. So okay. We have this. There's one person on the planet that knows how to do transthoracic echoes on dolphins, and we are lucky enough to have him in the area where we work in Valencia. So working with him and trying to understand these cardiorespiratory responses in dolphins from hypoxia, what they're doing when they're recovering from hypoxia, I think. Looking at the cardiac responses, comparing them to humans, and working with these people that are looking in breath hold humans and seeing what are the differences and what are the similarities and what can we learn from these animals that potentially could, you know, help save people during a stroke, during a heart attack. Are there things that we can learn from these animals?
That sounds fascinating. I wish I could. This type of thing makes me want to be a scientist.
I am super lucky because I get to work with some absolutely phenomenal people and some really interesting animals. So,
brilliant. Well, Andreas, I don't want to keep you any longer, but thank you very much.
Thank you.
From the oceans, we go to the air, and I now give you my conversation with Dr. Carl Soulsbury on birds exercising to the limits and beyond. Okay, Dr. Soulsbury, thank you for spending a bit of time with me. I wanted to just ask you to tell my listeners a little bit about your work and what you look at, what you do.
I think
that's a great place to start.
So I'm a behavioral and an evolutionary ecologist. I'm particularly interested in that interaction between animal behavior and how animals schedule their life events. So what determines when they reproduce, how frequently they reproduce, and ultimately when they die and their ultimate lifespan. Within that, I take an approach which is very comparative. So we've heard a lot of talks today about humans. Mm-hmm. I view humans as part of that comparative system. I don't see any differentiation between humans and animals as separate things. Across the animal kingdom, there are huge variation, all these different life history patterns. There are animals that will live for hundreds of years, all the way through to some that may only live very, very short number of months. And of course, within that, when they reproduce, how frequently they reproduce, is all very, very variable. The species I work on has exercise, or a component of exercise, as part of its life history. Yes. It seems to be very central into determining all these key events. So, A, when it reproduces, but also ultimately impacting its physiology and determining its aging process, its aging rate. So the talk I gave today was very much looking at the evidence for exercise as a bit of a determinant of aging process and aging rates across a number of comparative species.
And what I found really interesting is, and correct me if I interpreted your talk incorrectly, but in terms of birds, what you call exercise or physical activity has a very negative effect, intense exercise on life expectancy.
Potentially so. So I think it's key to define what exercise is. Because there is that almost misconception that exercise is a human phenomenon. But animals carry out physical activity. So the two things do equate to each other, analogous to each other. I think we conflate getting fit, which is a human condition, with what animals do. And I'm never suggesting animals try and get fit. Yes. That's separate. What I was trying to draw as a feature is that animals will work beyond what might be considered optimal for their physical health. And the reason they might do that is there's some fitness benefit. By fitness benefit, I mean they're more successful in reproducing, or they must have some kind of benefit downstream. And it makes great evolutionary sense that if they can get some benefit by working a little bit harder at a process, they would do more and more of it. Clearly, at some point, they must hit a maximum. Natural selection will butt against that and prevent them from going any further. But it's certainly possible, and certainly seems to be evidence, that animals work beyond what we consider to be optimal, and they're working a bit too hard and be costly and detrimental to their health.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I wanted to ask you this morning was, to what extent do the animals that you studied live beyond their reproductive age? Or to what extent do animals generally live beyond their reproductive age?
So it depends a little bit on species. There are many infamous cases amongst mammals which live beyond their reproductive age, postmenopausal. So killer whales, African elephants, for example. And they've shown that they themselves are quite important within their social systems, often as repositories of knowledge, social knowledge, for example. In the species I was studying, very few of them live beyond their post-reproductive lifespan. Some of them will live a number of years, but they'll still try and reproduce. Mm-hmm. For example, the males in my species will keep trying to attract females. They just won't be very successful at it. Mm-hmm. So in many respects, the females are trying to select the best quality, the most vigorous males displaying, and they're not displaying that quality anymore. They won't get selected. But they don't live very long after that. They might only live 1 or 2 years after that.
Right.
So there's a bit of a difference between those very long post-reproductive lifespans that some mammals have versus these very short lifespans, as we were looking at today.
Yes. And I presume that would be the key, or one of the key drivers, for a species to do rigorous exercise or physical activity to the point of detriment. They're not trying to get a PB in a marathon or what have you.
I mean, that short lifespan component is probably driven by that extra hard investment in some component of physical activity. Mm-hmm. Whereas those individuals with long post-reproductive lifespans suggest, I'm only seeing suggests, is they're not as huge investment into a physical activity or a component or something like that. It's not having the same negative impact on their lifespan that we find in some species.
Right.
We don't know what is changing, what component of the organism. So aging is not simultaneous across all the body's systems. Some bits fall apart a bit faster than others. In humans, for example, our taste buds decline a lot faster than parts of our cardiovascular system. Our brain size gets smaller as we get older. And undoubtedly within wild animals as well, there are different aging rates within the actual body. So the animal itself gets old, but the individual systems might age at different rates. And we don't yet know which parts are aging faster than others. Mm-hmm. We can speculate, and I suspect the immune system is probably quite important within that, but we don't know.
Mm-hmm. The section of the conference looked at human endurance, and I'm wondering if there's anything that you took away as you compare those types of studies with the work that you've done on other species.
So there was an interesting snippet added in that last talk about, although there was damage caused by this endurance exercise, still on average these endurance athletes live better than the general public.
Yes.
And that's what we find when we compare many studies, be that on Tour de France, cyclists for example, they live greater on average than the general population. What I do take away is that there's clearly negative impacts on health. There was evidence of damage to the heart. Humans live a lot longer. They have a lot of different other things surrounding them in their terms of their biology, which might ameliorate some of the other costs. But in the wild animal, they've got predation pressure, they've got parasites, they've got a number of pressures all acting upon them simultaneously. So I think actually the work that they've done there is very interesting, because it shows where some of that damage might lie. In certain contexts. So imagine birds flying continuously for thousands and thousands of kilometres. It suggests maybe it's putting a pressure on the cardiovascular system. Maybe they'd have some damage within their heart. So there are certain scenarios where this may be reflected both in the human and in the animals.
And I presume, a key difference may be, and this might be not a relevant factor, but after a big migration in bird migration or some intense physical activity, that's when a species is at their most vulnerable in terms of prey, for other species, which we wouldn't have as humans, obviously.
Undoubtedly, there'll be periods of vulnerability that might be associated in some species with a large exercise event. Certainly, again, in our study species, the biggest period of mortality is directly after they've carried out this intense physical exercise. And again, it may be that they're just more vulnerable to predation, or their immune systems are slightly shot to pieces and they're more vulnerable to parasites, which allow them to be predated. There's lots of things that may be causing it, but the exercise is the trigger in that decline, which leads to their reduced lifespan. So I think it's very important, as part of many animals' life histories, that intense, large physical exercise is a driver of survival, a driver of lifespan ultimately, and aging in general.
Okay. And final question is, what is most exciting in your field in terms of areas of research that are of particular interest?
That's a really difficult question. Because I have lots of interests, and I often try and bring different components and areas together. At the moment, I'm very interested in epigenetics. I have some work on my study species, for example, showing epigenetic changes, a few genes I've looked at across individuals' lives. And that in itself is quite interesting, suggesting that individuals are having to either switch on or switch off perhaps some genes. Maybe that's related to the exercise as they go along. I don't know, but there's some evidence as they're suggesting that these things are underpinned by epigenetic mechanisms, which would be very, very cool to look at in the future. But there's exciting developments with in terms of measuring exercise, quantifying exercise. I've enjoyed some of the techniques that have been used today within human-based studies, and we can learn a lot about looking to the human medicine for cool and innovative techniques we can try and apply in humans.
Very interesting. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you, no problem.
finally, from animals to humans, here is Dr. Andrew Jones talking about breaking the two-hour barrier in the marathon. So, Professor Jones, thank you for speaking to me. You are going to be talking about the two-hour marathon, and I'm just curious how you got interested in this as a topic.
Well, I think humans are fascinated with what the limitations to human performance are. You know, we like to sort of round things up. So there's the 10-second 100 meters and the 4-minute mile. And the latest thing in human endeavor really is the 2-hour marathon. People have been getting progressively closer to it. The current world record is 2 hours and 2. So there's been quite a lot of speculation from scientists and athletes and coaches about, you know, how and when and whether the 2-hour marathon will ever be beaten. And my own expertise and interest is in endurance physiology, especially running. And a couple of years ago, Nike decided that they would like to sort of lead the charge on this, to create the perfect environmental and other conditions to and select the athletes that might be capable of it and actually have them really attempt it. Because most marathon races, as you'll probably be aware, that, you know, the goal is to win the race rather than to run as fast as possible. So if you reset things and just had the goal to run as fast as possible and try to optimize all the conditions, the idea was to see just how close we could get. And I think Nike appreciated that they didn't have quite as much expertise in-house on distance running physiology. And I was delighted when they asked me to join that team. And I was on that journey with them over that two-year period, culminating in our attempt at the two-hour marathon back in May.
So how close are we?
Well, we got very close. So the existing sort of legitimate world record is 2 hours, 2 minutes and 57 seconds by Dennis Cometto. In the breaking two attempt that we did in the Monza Formula One racetrack in May, Eliud Kipchoge got very close. He ran 2 hours, 0 minutes, 25 seconds. So we took more than 2.5 minutes off the existing world record. It actually won't count as a legal world record for various things that we can discuss. But to get within 25 seconds of the two-hour barrier, I think, indicates that it is possible. So that's just one further second per mile to get to 1 hour, 59:59. So I think he got a lot closer than most people suspected he would. We weren't surprised, but we were also pleased at how fast he actually ran on the day.
That is unbelievably fast.
Yeah.
What are some of the factors that you think are going to take it over the edge? Is it the nutrition, the training? What goes into the two-hour marathon?
I think ultimately it's going to be about the athlete. And Eliud Kipchoge is clearly the best marathon runner in the world at the moment. Whether he's the best marathon runner ever is the critical thing. And ideally what you want is more Eliud Kipchoges. So in the race, you know, we selected 3 athletes that we thought were capable of it. One was Eritrean, one was Ethiopian, one was Kenyan. Ideally, you know, you would want to invite all of the best marathon runners in the world, irrespective of who sponsors them, to be in the same race at the same time and to work together collaboratively to try to, you know, where the goal is to run as fast as possible. And maybe you incentivize them financially to run as fast as possible. So ultimately, it's about the athlete and their own physiological characteristics. And then, you know, the other things are somewhat secondary, but nevertheless still important. So you need a really flat course without too many twists and turns, no ups and downs. You want perfect environmental conditions, so a still day, ideally around 10 degrees C. That seems to be optimal for heat dissipation to the environment. The athletes obviously have to be in their best condition, and you know, there might be some scientific aspects of the training that could be considered. And definitely a critical consideration is the nutrition, not so much prior to the race, but in particular during the race, because if you can use carbohydrate, so the glycogen that you store in your muscles, that actually reduces the energy costs. You have to consume less oxygen to run at a certain speed if the substrate that you're using is carbohydrate compared to fat. Now, the problem is that when you start the race, you probably haven't got quite enough carbohydrate to see you through the entire 26.2 miles. So the only way you can overcome that is by taking carbohydrate on board as you run. And we did a lot of work with the 3 athletes that were selected for the Breaking 2 attempt to try to get them to be better able to take on carbohydrate in the form of fluid. We had, you know, because the environmental conditions were relatively cool, hydration wasn't going to be a major issue, so we could focus on carbohydrate supply. So the fluids that we fed them were relatively rich in carbohydrate, and we were able to feed them more frequently than they would normally get in a standard marathon like Boston or Chicago or London. But nevertheless, we still didn't manage to get them to drink as much fluid or to intake as much carbohydrate as would have been ideal. So possibly there's a limiting factor there, and maybe some work could be done. Whether that's worth a further 25 seconds, I don't know, but it's worth some. The other thing that's really important and something we gave a lot of consideration to is air resistance and drafting. Now, if you're a runner and you're out on your own, maybe over the last 6 miles of a race, the energy demands get harder because all of a sudden you're on your own. You don't have anybody in front of you to break the air resistance. So one of the things we did in Breaking 2 was we introduced fresh pacemakers every 5K. And when we had our runners run behind really an arrowhead, if you will, of six pacemakers, and that reduces the energy cost by around 4%. So, you know, if you were to have a real attempt at a break into, you would need all of the runners in the race for as long as possible running at that speed and working together. Sometimes they will have to take the lead and bear the brunt of the air resistance, but most of the time they can be tucked in behind their colleagues.
I'm picturing a Tour de France stage where, you know, the cyclists work together until right at the very end, and they just go for it, and the fastest guy at the end wins.
Yeah, it's exactly like that, and I think in running, we haven't appreciated quite how valuable that can be. I mean, you see it on the track where quite often, like Mo Farah in the 5 and 10K, he'll sit in for as long as possible, realizing that that will reduce his energy cost, and he's got a faster sprint finish, and he'll retain more of that ability to sprint the more energy he can save early in the race. So the cyclists know very well how important being in the peloton is and drafting. It's less important at slower speeds, but it's still very important. And you do see in the marathon that the pack isn't very tight. It's very, very loose. And often, even if they look like they're drafting, they're not getting anything like the benefit they could if that pack in front of them were more tightly formed.
It's tactically just very different, though. As you say, they're not trying to break the two-hour record. They're just trying to win the race.
That's right.
So it gets stretched out. What have you learned about working with these athletes at these extremes that perhaps is applicable to other areas, maybe just to the recreational runner or to other parts of human physiology? Is there anything that you've taken away in the work that you've done?
I think what is interesting, we had the opportunity to go to East Africa and spend time with the runners in their camps, and it's striking how relatively unscientific their approach is. But they have a belief system. They have there's a whole philosophical structure around what they do, and it's very natural. So, I think in the UK and in the States and so on, we're very structured in what we do, and we delight in the detail. And I think that's all very well, but I think sometimes living alongside nature, changing the training according to how you feel on a daily basis. Believing in the coach, believing in the history, all of those psychological and sociological things actually are more important than I'd like to give credit for, really, as an exercise physiologist.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting aspect of it. And the environment induces all kinds of subtle changes, I'm sure. This is fascinating stuff. When is the next formal attempt at the two-hour record?
I'm not sure that. I mean, talking of risk, it was a real big risk for Nike to invest in attempting to make this happen. And I think that the marathon is such a unpredictable event. It's not like the 100 meters or the mile where you can run it. If it goes wrong, you can recover in a week and you can try again or a day. It does depend a lot upon how the athlete feels on the day. And you've got to get the weather right and everything right. And it was an expensive thing to try to do. I think Nike were actually, in the end, quite pleased, because it could have been a disaster. We could have run 2:05 or 2:08 or something like that. So to get as close as we did, I think everyone was quite satisfied by. Now, we didn't quite go under 2, but I think what we demonstrated is that it can be done. And that was part of the deal, really. Mm-hmm. So I don't think, but I may be wrong, because I don't actually work for Nike. It may be the case that there's an attempt that may yet occur, probably not for a couple of years, but maybe some attempt in the future. But I think what people are thinking of now is how do we structure something in a legitimate event. Now, Berlin is the most that's the fastest course in the world, in Berlin. If you were able to have all of the best athletes there and you change the goalposts a little bit to make it more about running as fast as possible, then that would be the way to do it, I think. But even so, the weather in Berlin this year was much hotter than people wanted it to be. Eliud Kipchoge won that race, but in 2:03:30, when he was probably in 2:01 shape, and the weather was just dreadful. It was a bit warmer, but it was also blustery and raining, so that didn't help his prospects at all. So you need those sorts of things. But the athlete needs to feel good on the day. It's one of those things that you can't predict. It's totally unpredictable. You can have everything right scientifically. You can have the weather right. You can have the course right. But if the athlete has a bad day, then you're not going to see anything done.
Do you think that once it happens, that we'll have a similar Bannister effect where all of a sudden we get loads? How much of it is mental? How much do you think once it happens, loads of other runners will, well, not, maybe not loads, but a few others will start to break that barrier?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely possible. I mean, people felt that running under sub 4 minutes for a mile was impossible. And I think there are hundreds have done it now, and several did it within a couple of months of Bannister first doing it. So I think it just resets people's mindsets as much as anything. And, you know, I think when the world record, well, you know, it was, or the fastest time ever run for the marathon was 2:02, then the 18-year-olds around the world and in Kenya and Ethiopia in particular were thinking, well, you know, maybe one day I can run 2:01. But now Eliud Kipchoge's run 2 hours and 25 seconds, they'd be thinking, maybe I can be, you know. So they're already thinking differently about it. But yeah, we need more talented athletes training with that goal in mind, I think. But I think we've certainly expedited this thing. I was always convinced that it would happen, and I believe it will happen. If you do the trajectory, you would say that it might take 50 or 60 years for it to happen. Well, that was the case before we did the...
Right,
but now we've done the 2:00:25. I think we've brought it forward
decade.
By... Yeah, I think 5 to 10 years. I think it's possible. So so that's an absolute success of this. I think it has changed the way people think about it. So we've... as I say, I think expedited the route to that sub 2.
It's fabulous. Professor Jones, thank you very much for joining me. This was great. I'm looking forward to the rest of your talk. But
thank you.
Thank you very much.
I appreciate it. Cheers.
I hope you guys found that interesting and useful. Let me know what you think of the format. Now, I can't say that I plan on attending loads of these types of conferences in the future, but if you think this was useful, if you liked this, then please let me know, allthingsrisk@gmail.com. And as usual, links to this episode's 3 speakers and to the Human Nature Conference itself are in the show notes. We'll be back and in long form format next week on December the 26th. That's Tuesday of next week, the day after Christmas. And if you can't bear to wait for the next episode, just visit allthingsrisk.co.uk, and I'm sure you'll find something from a back catalog that will give you your fix. And you can also find every way in which you can subscribe to the show. We are found wherever you find great podcasts. Until then, and as always, don't forget, risk is life.